Hello, everyone, and thanks to the fine folk over on Patreon for voting for this particular subject. What they asked for was essentially a short list of the small ships that kept the supplies and logistics side going, so the escorts for convoys and so forth. Now, I looked into this and very quickly realized that exactly what kind of escort you get on which kind of convoy depends very much on where those convoys are. So, for example, a supply convoy heading from the western coast of the United States to Australia is not going to be anywhere near as heavily escorted as a supply convoy heading from New York to Liverpool, for instance. But the makeup of those escorts is also going to change quite dramatically. In that both cases, you need a heavy anti-submarine screen, but depending on what time of year it is and what stage in the war you're looking at, the Atlantic convoy is probably going to need a far greater number of anti-surface escorts, i.e. ships that can go toe-to-toe with a German raider should it show up, whereas Japanese commerce raiders weren't really too much of a concern in the depths of the South Pacific. And then you have things like the Mediterranean and Arctic convoys. While there was a need for anti-aircraft capability on the Atlantic convoys to combat long-range German strike aircraft, it wasn't a massively high one. Whereas if you're running the Arctic or Mediterranean convoys, or even some of the convoys that ran from, say, Gibraltar up past the Bay of Biscay and to the UK, those convoys could come under much more significant air attack. Malta resupply convoys probably being the pièce de résistance of that particular category, and therefore far more anti-aircraft capability would be needed. And that could come in the form of the escort ships themselves having more anti-aircraft guns, a different kind of escort ship being used, or indeed full-scale deployments by regular fleet units, again, particularly the Malta convoys being the major example, where you could have aircraft carriers, heavy and light cruisers, and capital ships there. And while these would form a guard against surface attack as well, should the Regia Mariner sail in the Mediterranean or the Kriegsmarine warships in Norway sail in the Arctic, a lot of their role was to provide heavy anti-aircraft support. And then you even have the invasion convoys, the short distance ones like the ones heading from the UK to France for D-Day, and the extremely long distance ones heading from various US-controlled ports to various Japanese-controlled islands in the Western Pacific. But since the question was primarily about the smaller ships, I decided two things. Firstly, apart from merchant ship conversions and escort carriers, we're going to leave out anything that's substantially larger than a destroyer, because small ships are small. And secondly, we're going to focus mainly on the kind of ships you could expect to see on the Atlantic and possibly Arctic convoy routes, mainly because if you're trying to balance up danger and length of time spent traveling and sheer number of convoys run, the Atlantic is of course the crucible for most convoy operations and certainly most of the famous ones, but the Arctic does get a bit of a look in as well. So what this is going to be is a look at the small ships primarily of those convoys, but you would also find a number of these kinds of ships, in fact most of these kinds of ships, on other convoy routes as well. And it should serve to cover most of the ships you could expect to see. Of course, if you think I've left out a particular type of vessel, then feel free to let us know in the comments below and we can follow up with specific details on some of those more niche vessels. With that said, let's get on with it. So some of the smallest ships you could expect to see on convoy escort duty would be ships like this. This is an Isles-class naval trawler. And as you can see from the men arranged there on the bow, these are not large ships. As we go through, what we'll be doing is with each type of ship, we'll be taking a few exemplar classes rather than going through every single class, because there are a lot of ship types where there are a few fairly large classes and then half a dozen or more small classes that might run into single digit numbers produced, maybe low double digit numbers. But if we went through every single one, well, there goes most of my 5 minute guides for the small ships apart from anything else, and we'd be here all week. So Isles class, a really good example of a naval trawler. Back in World War I, naval trawlers had been both constructed directly for the Navy, but also taken up in large part from commercial service. While a number of trawlers were taken up from commercial service in the Second World War, including, ironically enough, quite a number of Castle-class naval trawlers that had been purpose-built for the Navy in World War I, sold into private service during the interwar period, and were then retaken into naval service in World War II, during the Second World War, the vast majority of naval trawlers were actually purpose-built vessels. And honestly, they weren't anybody's first choice for convoy escorts. They were small, usually around 500 tons, give or take a couple of hundred, fairly slow. Quite a lot of them could only make around 12 to 13 knots, which meant that they would actually be outpaced by fast convoys and could only really just about keep pace with slower ones. And their armament wasn't all that much to write home about. Very often, they'd have a single 3-inch gun, maybe a 4-incher up front, a handful of anti-aircraft guns later on in the war, starting out with a handful of machine guns, later a few 20mm Oerlikons, and that was about it. They would also be fitted with some depth charges, and in most cases when they were put on convoy escort work, an ASDIC or sonar, but they really were something of a last-ditch defence for a convoy, because one of the major problems that was encountered repeatedly when it came to escorting convoys and dealing with anti-submarine threats was that ideally you wanted to spot and attack a submarine well away from a convoy, using radar, aircraft recon, intelligence, HFDF, so high-frequency direction finding, or a number of other methods of spotting a sub. However, prior to the significant rise in the use of escort carriers in the mid-war period, you would have to detach one of your escorts to go out and deal with that sub. And if the sub saw them coming, they could, of course, dive and try to escape. And if your escort wasn't particularly quick, then by the time they reached the point where the submarine had decided it was going to dive, the chances of that submarine being anywhere near that location were pretty slim. And, you know, with a 12-knot top speed, it would be relatively hard for a naval trawler to then track down a U-boat, because a U-boat moving at a fair clip underwater might be almost as fast in the early war, and in the later war possibly even marginally faster than the trawler. So even if the trawler was capable of physically catching up with a sub, it could take a very long time. So the sub had a fairly decent chance of evading. The sub might be able to actually beat a trawler in a gunfight if it came to the surface. And even if the attack was successful in either destroying, damaging, or driving off the submarine, the trawler would then need hours, possibly days, to catch up to the convoy. And all the time it was away from the convoy, there was now a trawler-shaped hole in the defensive perimeter. But they were a source of firepower, especially against aircraft, and so naval trawlers did see a fair bit of service as convoy escorts, a lot in coastal convoys, but even in some deep ocean convoys, almost entirely because there just weren't the numbers of larger escorts to provide sufficient protection for the convoy. And they were, of course, data points. If they had ASDIC equipped, they could ping away looking for submarines, and they had depth charges, so they could physically attack subs. But most often, when naval trawlers were involved in convoy escort, they would stick fairly close to the convoy and be used more so to plug the gaps that would be left by the larger, more capable escorts when they went motoring off to attack submarines away from the convoy, with the trawlers then holding the line, hopefully blocking the approach of various submarines that might either have slipped past the detached larger escorts or might have been waiting for that opportunity to dive into a gap in the convoy's defences. Another escort type, although far more purpose-built for escorting convoys against submarines, but available in relatively speaking small numbers, was the sloop. This had been reintroduced as a class or concept in the First World War, and in the interwar period had been built in the Royal Navy, and both by and for various other navies that were related to the Royal Navy, like the Australian and Canadian navies, in part because the type was actually unregulated by the various treaties. It was of a small enough displacement, a small enough speed, and lacked particularly large guns, and therefore you could build as many of them as you liked, if you happened to have the budget for them. Generally, these were built in small classes to start with, and their displacement could range between 500 and 1,000 tons, the Shoreham class, as seen here, being a particular example of this smaller type, typically armed with a couple of 4-inch guns, occasionally on the smaller types just the one. They were rigged from the start with depth charges, ASDIC as it became available, and a small number of anti-aircraft weapons. The smaller types were capable of about 16 knots, which was faster than the trawlers, but as the 1930s rolled on, the sloop type got a significant upgrade in the shape of the Bitten, Egret, and Black Swan classes. This is a Bitten class, particularly HMS Stork, and their speed increased to between 18 and 20 knots, depending on the exact sloop class in question. Their firepower increased substantially. You can see here twin 4-inch guns up front, and there would be, depending on the class, either another twin 4-inch aft or even two twin 4-inch aft on the Egret class for a total of 8 guns. Being larger and faster, they were of course more seaworthy, they could carry more depth charges, they had ASDIC fitted from the start as opposed to trawlers, which often had them retrofitted as an emergency measure so that they could do convoy escort work, and they were generally fairly well liked by their crews. They were of course still relatively small vessels, so their idea of a very seaworthy escort has a certain limited value when it comes to sailing in the rougher seas of the Atlantic and the Arctic. But they were still significantly more stable than corvettes, which we'll come on to a bit later. You could also have some rather hilarious incidents, especially with the Black Swan class, which you can see here. This is Black Swan herself, where thanks to having twin gun mounts and a layout that resembled, depending on whether you're looking at a Black Swan or an Egret, either a Leander or an Arethusa type light cruiser, when they were operating in formation, especially if they were operated aggressively, long-distance enemy recon aircraft could sometimes mistake them for cruisers or indeed entire cruiser squadrons, which had something of an unintended deterrent effect when it came to whether or not German destroyers would sortie out to attack convoys that were near their bases in the Bay of Biscay. The two main limiting factors to sloops were that although they did have significant inspiration from certain merchant ship-style design measures, they were still, to a reasonable degree, built to naval standards and carried a relatively heavy armament, which meant that even with the Black Swan class built in reasonably large numbers for a sloop class during the war, there were never anywhere close to enough of them to be the main force of a convoy's escort. But especially in the early part of the Second World War, they were often some of the best anti-submarine escorts available. And as other anti-submarine escorts became available for convoys, you would see sloops forming the cores of the very first hunting groups formed, both to directly hunt U-boats completely independently of the convoys or to act as essentially strengthening forces, which would show up and help to escort a convoy that had its own fixed escort in the most dangerous portions of the oceans. They'd then break off and go off to find another convoy to help separately. Captain Johnny Walker, of course, famously took his second escort group or second support group out against the U-boats on multiple occasions, scoring a great deal of success with a variety of sloops, including, of course, the extremely famous flagship of his force, HMS Starling, as seen here. But while sloops were never available in enough numbers for the Allies' liking, this meant that trawlers weren't the only ships not really designed for convoy work that were dragged into it. Meet the mine layers, in this case the Halcyon class mine layer, but again a number of other mine layer classes are available. The clue is in the name as to what their actual original purpose was, and at around about 800 tons and about 16 knots, give or take, again, depending on the class, and even in some cases, depending on the ship within the class, these vessels were fundamentally not designed for convoy escort work. Their main armament consisted of a 3-inch gun or a 4-inch gun, or if you were really lucky, perhaps two 4-inch guns. They weren't designed to carry ASDIC, they weren't designed to carry depth charges, but some of them were quickly retrofitted to do so, simply because while being a mine layer dash mine sweeper was a valuable role, the simple fact was that after the initial laying of the minefields that were designed to stop U-boats, and the occasional tactical minefield laid to catch German coastal craft in the channel, the Royal Navy was mostly then down to maintaining existing minefields rather than trying to deploy new ones. And if they were deploying new ones in, say, something like the Norwegian campaign, they tended to use destroyers because they were faster and longer range. And that meant that these mine layers very often, much like the trawlers, got shanghaied into providing convoy escort. In this role, being somewhat larger and somewhat faster than trawlers, they could, like the sloops, partake in actual pursuits of enemy U-boats, although again, you probably wouldn't necessarily want to get in a straight-up gunfight with most submarines. And their more limited anti-submarine suites meant that they had to pick and choose exactly when they dropped their depth charges with somewhat more care. They couldn't sustain attacks as long as a dedicated escort. And of course, while their 16 to 17 knot top speed meant they could leave a convoy, attack a U-boat and claw their way back, it would still take them some time. And so as the war went on, the number of minesweepers being used as convoy escorts would drop off quite dramatically, unless you were looking at a case where enemy-laid mines might actually be a significant problem, particularly if you were coming into port, such as on some of the Arctic convoy routes, when their primary original purpose as a minesweeper and mine layer could be used to fairly significant effect, along with the fact that they made a semi-decent anti-sub escort as long as it stayed close to the convoy, and of course, as with all armed naval ships, did provide at least a smattering of anti-aircraft fire to try and dissuade enemy air attacks. Or at least that was the general idea. HMS Bramble, of course, gained some fame at the Battle of Barents Sea after having become somewhat detached from the main convoy, when it ran into the German heavy cruiser Admiral Hipper, along with various escorts, any one of which massively outgunned it, and Hipper, of course, massively, massively outgunning it. But in the finest tradition of the Royal Navy, Bramble decided that if she was going to go down anyway, she was going to go down fighting and open fire on Hipper, which was much to the Germans' consternation. They did, of course, sink Bramble in fairly short order, but it was a show of defiance that both, as I said, epitomised the ideals of the Royal Navy and actually gave the convoy some notice that of where roughly Hipper was. And that brings us along to the corvette. These would go on to become some of the most familiar anti-submarine escorts, but they were only ordered right before the Second World War actually broke out, the vast majority of them being flower class. The idea behind a corvette was a resurrected term because they didn't have a particular designation for these dedicated anti-submarine vessels. They were bigger and a little bit faster than a trawler at around about 920 to 1,000 tons and about 16 knots, but they clearly were not as large, not as fast, and not as heavily armed as a sloop, which, as we've established already, had multiple 4-inch guns, whereas the corvettes tended to just have a single deck gun, then a bunch of anti-aircraft guns, and a whole load of depth charges at the back, although they could be refitted with other weapons as time went on. But the purpose of the corvette was to allow vast numbers to be built as quickly as humanly possible. Small size helped with that, but also they were built largely to merchant standards based off existing fishing and whaling designs, and that meant that smaller shipyards that couldn't handle destroyers or couldn't even handle potentially sloops or the larger frigates that were being designed at the same time, could build corvettes. And so vast numbers of corvettes would enter service. Now, the speed, as you might have picked up from some of the other ships that we've looked at already, would be a little bit of an Achilles heel for the corvettes, simply because while they were just about quick enough to chase down submarines underwater, they weren't actually fast enough to close the distance on a U-boat that was making good speed on the surface in a lot of cases, and even in the cases of the slower U-boats or the ones that were a bit slow off the starting block, it was a very, very close run thing. And of course, if they left the convoy, there was then a gap in the convoy's escort coverage, and many submarine tactics, whether they be Italian, German, or the occasional Japanese submarine attack when there was more than one of them present, would very often hope to draw out a corvette from the escort screen because its 16 knot top speed would make it quite a struggle to regain its escort position in good time once its initial hunt was over. And this, of course, would open a gap in the convoy's defences wherein other submarines could slip in. The Wolfpacks particularly were quite good at this. The flip side to that, of course, was to try and have so many corvettes that it didn't matter. You could send a corvette or two out and other corvettes could just slightly readjust their position and continue to screen the convoys. But again, in the early part of the Second World War, and even up to the mid part in 1943, when, yes, corvettes were becoming more and more numerous and were able to replace or supplement less suitable escorts, there were still limited numbers of them, and so the tactic would prove quite effective for enemy submarines right up until the latter part of the Second World War, when there were just so many escorts available in general that you could afford to detach several anti-submarine escorts and not really substantially weaken the defensive perimeter. And while they gave sterling service, one of the other issues that they found with the Flower class in particular was that it tended to roll on anything much damper than wet grass, to the point that at one stage in an Atlantic storm, two corvettes were sailing nearby each other. One radioed to the other, asking what their status was, and they essentially said they were fine, but they also commented that the first corvette's boiler fires looked really good because it had been rolling so much that some of the lookouts on the second corvette could actually look down the funnel at the extreme ends of the roll. Still, the corvette crews persevered and were massively helpful in protecting the convoys. You know, just because they had some downsides to the design didn't mean they weren't exceptionally useful. But as time went on, and it became clear that while the newer, faster, more heavily armed frigates, which we'll come to in a moment, were going to be better anti-submarine escorts, the simple fact was that some of the shipyards that could produce corvettes could also produce frigates, but some of them couldn't. And so an updated version of the Flower class, the Castle class, which was slightly longer, slightly heavier, and as a result could be armed with the Squid system, was made available in the mid to late portion of the Second World War. These ships were considerably more seaworthy, fractionally faster, although not by a huge amount, but their main claim to fame was the ability to use the Squid anti-submarine mortar. A lot of Flower class had either had the Hedgehog system added or had it replace one of their other weapon systems, but the Hedgehog, while it was great in that it gave them an ahead attack capability, did have a single major limitation, and that was that each of the charges was small enough you had to score a direct hit on a submarine. And sometimes even a direct hit wouldn't necessarily cripple or destroy the sub if it hit an extremity or the conning tower or something like that. Whereas the Squid system could throw an entire full-scale depth charge, or indeed three, out ahead of a ship, and of course a depth charge didn't need a direct hit to inflict damage, potentially fatal damage, and a direct hit definitely would inflict fatal damage. The problem was the Squid system was larger and heavier than Hedgehog, and therefore the Flower class couldn't carry it, but the enlarged forecastle of the Castle class meant that they could. Next up in size you had the Frigate, which was under development right from the very start of the Second World War, but would only actually really enter service in the middle of the Second World War. And this started out with the River class. Originally to be called twin screw corvettes, they were a little bit larger and considerably faster than the Flower class, with the River class coming in at around about 20 knots top speed and just under 1400 tons displacement. Speed varied depending on exactly which propulsion plant was fitted, and things escalated from there. They were considerably more seaworthy than a corvette and also considerably more heavily armed. Having 4 4-inch guns instead of just one in a pair of twin mounts, one fore, one aft, and these twin 4-inch guns were usually fully anti-aircraft capable, whereas a lot of the single 4-inch guns on the corvettes were either just not anti-aircraft capable because they couldn't elevate high enough, or they were only notionally so because they were fully manually aimed. Being larger, there was also a significantly greater small-caliber anti-aircraft battery, anything from 10 or more 20mm mounts. Some later frigates would have 40mm mounts. They came with Hedgehog ahead-throwing launchers as standard, as well as a significant battery of depth charges and depth charge throwers, plus rails. As well as the increased gun armament, making them more suited for convoy escort work closer to where Axis air power still was something of a problem, the increased number of depth charges combined with built-in Hedgehog from the very beginning made them much more effective anti-submarine warfare vessels. The speed also helped greatly. since it meant that the River class was much, much more capable of hunting down U-boats under the water, as they had a very large speed advantage, similar to some of the higher performance sloops. And even on the surface, they were still faster than the vast majority of submarines that they would be hunting. And of course, as well as being able to track them down and hunt them down faster, the fact that they had a significantly greater main gun armament meant that they could start shelling the submarines earlier with a decent chance to hit them. And once the hunt was concluded at a speed of 20 knots, they could much more quickly and easily regain their station with the convoy, which narrowed margins of opportunity when you faced multi-submarine attacks for an attacker to get inside and attack the merchant shipping. There were only two real disadvantages to the River class, one of which was that because it was slightly larger, some shipyards that could build corvettes couldn't build River class frigates, which was why the Castle class was invented, as we mentioned earlier. But also, being an early war design and put together in something of a rush, there were a few minor issues with seakeeping. As I said, they were considerably better at seakeeping than the Flower class, but there was room for improvement. A couple of River class would be sent off to the United States where they'd be analysed, and they would actually form the basis of the Tacoma class frigates, which would be built both for the United States and also sent back to the Royal Navy as the Captain class. These ships were slightly larger than the River class, roughly the same speed, but had a very different main armament, using the US 3-inch gun rather than the British twin 4-inch. And being US built, they were able to take advantage of some of the early released versions of the 40mm Bofors gun, which the US was beginning to produce in large quantities. And much as the Castle class corvettes reflected lessons applied to the Flower class design, the River class would be primarily followed up by the Lock class frigates, which similarly brought in things like the Squid anti-submarine mortar, throwing full-size depth charges in place of the Hedgehog, as well as better seakeeping, and being designed in the middle of World War II for introduction in service towards the end of World War II, the Lock class also featured an even heavier anti-aircraft armament. Although you might think it was something of a step back when you initially look at pictures of a Lock class and realise there's only a single 4-inch gun up forward, a bit like a Flower class corvette, as opposed to the two twin 4-inch mounts on a River class. But this was compensated for by a considerable increase in light and medium anti-aircraft firepower, as well as, of course, the introduction of Squid, which was in the form of two separate triple-barrel launchers on a frigate, as opposed to a single launcher on a corvette. And this recognition of a growing air threat, as the sheer number of dedicated anti-submarine vessels was beginning to have quite the telling effect on the Axis submarine fleets, was shown with the development of the Bay class, which were essentially Lock class hulls, but reverting to a more river-like armament with two twin 4-inch guns, plus lots of medium and short-range anti-aircraft guns, and a reversion to the Hedgehog launcher to save weight. So these became more anti-aircraft than anti-submarine frigates, but still designed for convoy escort work, but particularly designed for convoy escort both in the areas around Northern Europe, where Germany was still fighting, and particularly in anticipation of operations in the Western Pacific, where, of course, the primary form of convoy escort was for troop and invasion convoys going after Japanese holdings, where there were lots and lots of kamikazes and other slightly less suicidal strike aircraft waiting for them. Another small escort in the range that we're looking at that could be found in the deep ocean was the PCE 842 class. This was a patrol craft built by the US Navy, and it's at the smaller end of things, at about 850 to 900 tons, capable of around about 16 knots, and armed, as you can see there, with a single 3-inch caliber gun up front, a mixture of 40mm and 20mm Bofors guns, and a Hedgehog launcher, plus depth charges. Now, these vessels were actually the final evolution of the submarine chaser, if you like. The submarine chasers generally being considerably smaller vessels, often designed for coastal work, whereas the PCE 842 class were just about large enough to make it out into the deeper ocean. Some would be transferred to the Royal Navy, others would be kept by the US Navy, and as you might have surmised from the various statistics of the other ships that we've been considering, They weren't the ideal long-distance deep ocean escort. They were middle of the pack heading towards low in terms of speed. They're obviously about the same speed, maybe a fraction slower than a Corvette. Just a little bit smaller. And as a result, fractionally less heavily armored for anti-submarine work. But they were still serviceable and they would show up quite a bit in convoy escorts during the mid-war period. Though by the end of the war, they had been supplanted by larger, more capable vessels. And the last class of deep ocean convoy escort that I want to talk about today is the Hunt-class escort destroyer. This is distinct from the US destroyer escort type, both being built in Britain and designed for slightly different purposes, although both broadly have a similar mandate. The interesting thing is that whereas the destroyer escort starts out slow and gets faster and considerably more heavily armed in the gun department, the Hunt class, while it doesn't slow down, starts out considerably faster than the destroyer escorts and reduces its armament as time goes on. So the Hunt class were initially built as essentially a small, cheap destroyer of around about 1,000 tons, so similar displacement to a frigate, but having considerably heavier armament with four twin 4-inch guns, so similar to some of the more heavily armed sloops, for a total of 8 main guns, and with much, much higher speed of 27 to 28 knots. And this is because they were designed to essentially be dual-purpose escorts. Most of what we've looked at so far was designed to be specifically convoy protection vessels, whereas the Hunt class was designed to also be able to screen the main battle fleet, hence the need for a higher speed. But as the Hunt class continued to be built in three separate batches, while the first batch had the 8 guns, the next batch moved on to just having 6 guns, so similar to some of the other larger later era sloops, by simply deleting a twin mount. The third set went down to 4 guns, although the fourth and final set went up again to 6 guns in 3 twin mounts. And as the batches went on, they had progressively heavier and heavier light and medium anti-aircraft armament and, generally speaking, a increased depth of magazine for or storage for their depth charges. Although the Type 4s, the last variant, did have fewer depth charges, but they were only a 2-ship class. So most of the time you'll see the Type 3s with the 4 guns in 2 twin mounts seen as the final primary variant. Unlike most anti-submarine escorts built in the middle of the war, they actually generally lacked Hedgehog launchers, partly because they relied on their significant increase in speed compared to most escorts, as we said, capable of doing between 27 and 28 knots on a good day, with some of the later variants perhaps dropping down to 25 to 26 knots when fully loaded, to be able to rush out, chase down and overhaul U-boats in a much swifter and more efficient manner than the slower escorts could. And therefore, they could make do with the depth charges because they could easily rely on passing over their targets rather than having to pursue them in a tail chase. These were actually built relatively early on, but interestingly, they weren't immediately thrown into anti-submarine convoy escort work wholesale. This was in part because of their speed, allowing them to operate with the fleet, and the rather catastrophic levels of destroyer fleet losses and ships knocked out of action needing a refit in the early part of the war. A good number of them were thrown straight into the front line, or you could almost look at some of their duties as near frontline duties. So, for example, in the Mediterranean, while the Hunt class didn't necessarily accompany Cunningham's Mediterranean fleet out on all its many adventures, you could occasionally find them there, and you could definitely find them escorting the Mediterranean convoys making a run to Malta, which was a task that was usually done by significant fleet elements. And of course, the Hunt class had the speed to keep up with them, hence their usage. So their sheer capability meant that it was only once wartime emergency flotilla destroyers and other such vessels could start to come into play that you start to see more and more of the Hunt class proportionally on convoy work as opposed to operating partly on convoy work and partly on fleet duty. Their speed also making them very popular for various dedicated anti-submarine hunting groups as the war went on. And while that brings us to the end of the main types of small deep ocean anti-submarine convoy escort vessels, which for this video is essentially ships that can actually make it across the Atlantic or over to Murmansk, etc., and either generally displace up to about 1,200 tons or were dedicated anti-submarine vessels, it does mean that there are a few ships which we haven't mentioned, although a lot of them have been covered elsewhere on the channel in various videos, which I would classify as a sort of a mid-size or mixed-use escort vessel. And that will include things like, as you can see here, the destroyer escorts that the US built, because they were somewhat larger and also, like the Hunt class, spent quite a lot of time escorting fleet units as much as they did convoys, but they definitely did a convoy escort as well. You also have older destroyers in the 1300 to 1400 ton range, plus or minus a little bit, which were hauled in for use on convoy escort simply because there wasn't any better alternative. So this could be both British World War One and immediate post-World War One destroyers, as well as famously, of course, the Town class, aka the four stackers. And of course, there are also the much larger dedicated convoy escort vessels like catapult armed merchantmen, merchant aircraft carriers, the escort carriers themselves, armed merchant cruisers, which were sometimes used in these roles, anti-aircraft merchant ships, something a lot of people have never really heard of, but are actually quite interesting, and of course, convoy rescue ships. So if at some point you want me to do a follow-up video which talks about these mid and larger sized convoy escort vessels and vessels that had a considerably greater dual use, then, well, I can consider doing that later on this year. But for now, I hope this quickfire guide to the small ships that kept the supply lines open in the major convoy battles of World War II has been helpful, and I'll see you again in another video sometime soon.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.